Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
I'm Mark Kermode.
And I'm Simon Mayer.
And we're on BBC Radio 5 Live. Very nice. Now, over the year, as in the year that's just gone, we've been visited by the great and the good who've wanted to discuss and promote in a casual manner their new films. So it only seems fair, and it fills a bit of time, that we revisit some of the interviews which we've enjoyed the most over 2009. Before that, though, I guess we should wish a Happy New Year to Jason Isaacs.
Happy New Year, Jason.
To Fairport Convention.
Happy New Year, Fairport.
The Subways.
Happy New Year, the Subways.
Which is always just Billy.
Yeah, is it? No, it's Billy and Charlatan.
You know, yeah, it's always just Billy.
Yeah, fine.
Michael Sheen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year in all your many incarnations, whether leather-trousered or being upmarket.
And Stephen Fry and David Morrissey, a Happy New Year. Now, Stephen and Dave, of course, were good enough to join us in May for A Touch of Wittertainment and to review David's latest film. Terrifying skinheads just walked into the studio. I thought they've let someone in.
Oh, my God, there he is.
It turns out it's David Morrissey.
How are you?
Hello, David, how are you?
I'm He's been
well.
Having a series of bad hair days.
Oh, a series?
Well,
I
did watch Is There Anybody There?
Ah, I see where you're coming from.
And there's some hair.
Well, we have to say that your hairstyle in Is Anybody There?
Uh-huh.
Is
the worst hairstyle
ever.
Anyone has ever had.
I was prepared for that. I know this isn't great radio.
What have
you done? I do have a picture here of Simon.
Oh, go on.
In mid-80s.
Spiky with mullet.
So I should think.
Whoa!
Oh, let's have a look.
So,
no, that's Mark Goodyear, isn't it?
Oh.
Look at that.
Blimey, Charlie.
So, you know, I. Was that a publicity shot?
I still look like that.
For those who can't see it, i.e. those who are listening
well,
on
I think
the
we
radio,
can put it on the podcast.
It's semi-centre parted. It appears to be blonde highlighted. A volcanic explosion of hair from the centre. Yeah, but some people might be
it
driving.
Looks as if you were auditioning to be the third member of Dollar.
I think Bross is probably closer to the fourth member.
So I can. I think you should see my research into the period was...
I like that very much. However, it still makes your haircut the worst ever in movie history.
Only because you never did a movie at the time.
No, that's true. So but it's sort of 19... What's the period that
you... It's mid-80s, but obviously he's a man who, you know, he's of a certain age, so his influences were all the 70s when he's growing up. So when we first see him in the beginning of the film, he's sort of very hippie-ish. But he's trying to be young and hip and, like... Everyone of a certain age trying to be young and hippie gets it terribly wrong.
I have to say, straight out, I loved the film. I absolutely loved it. And what was so good was the contrast of you, yes, exactly, having that 80s thing, and this fantastic gallery of British character actors. Yeah. I mean, Sylvia Sim, Rosemary Harris, Leslie Phillips, Peter Vaughan.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Liz Spriggs, they were all there. My God, they were on top form.
Yeah.
It really was. And that boy as well. So you had all the generations, the boy who was in the marvellous Son of Rambo.
Recently on Skellig as well. I mean, he builds a really exceptional talent, I think. And seeing him and Michael together was fantastic. You know, just how they worked together was really good.
Wasn't it? I mean, he gave him as good as he got. I mean, he was occasionally as grouchy as Michael Caine's
And also,
character.
Michael's a really generous actor. I mean, he's someone who, like, with all of us, but obviously with a young boy, it's more important. But he does give him his time. You know, there's nothing patronising about him. He comes to work, he's a great professional, all those things.
Yeah.
So we had fun. And you're right with all the cast. I mean, the stories of them all. And they've all known each other for years as well. So it was great.
Here's a quote from Michael Caine. This is what Michael Caine was saying on the show on Wednesday. We were talking about Bill Milner. And so this is Michael Caine. On Bill.
He's the best child actor I've ever seen. The best child actor I've ever seen was Shirley Temple. But this guy is really incredible. And what it is about him, he's a natural movie actor. He's never been trained in theatre to do those exaggerated movements or anything as you have to in the theatre. And so he was ideal for us. And he has a great non-stage mother, which is another advantage for him.
Just that's fascinating that you can that he's a great movie actor at this very young age. Is it that he knows the camera angles? Does he instinctively know cameras? Is that what it is?
He distinctively knows how to be a real little boy in an extraordinary situation. I mean, a little boy can be a real little boy playing football. But we put him into some extraordinary situations and an extraordinary relationship with an extraordinary old man who he doesn't know. and he still knows how to do it. He's quite uncanny. And the great thing for me is acting with him is not like acting with a child where you're going, oh, well, they've just fluffed it, that we'll do it again. You know what I mean? And you're being solicitous of a child all the time. He's like acting with another adult actor, although he's not precocious at all.
So my paraphrase of that, David, is essentially he's the best child actor Shirley Temple.
Yeah. Well, I've not seen him dance, so I don't know whether he'll surpass that. But, Michael's absolutely right. You know, you've got no sense of having to work differently around Bill or sort of make time for him. You know, he really did get... He took on the role and he did it wonderfully well, I think. And, you know, that was all part of being comfortable on the set, telling his story. Also, the person within all that is John Crowley, who was the director who creates that atmosphere for him, you know, and they worked very well together.
He made Boy A, didn't he?
He made Boy A.
He made Intermission as well, didn't he? Which is really good.
And also, he's done a lot of theatre. I mean, he's a great actor's director, as I think you can see through his work all the time.
I think the other thing with film actors that you're either born with or you aren't is that this desire an audience has that you almost sit forward, you want to know what they're thinking. Yeah. You just look in... He's 10 years old or something?
Yeah, 12? I think he was about 11 then.
11.
Yeah.
And the word compelling is often used, but it is, you are compelled to want to know.
It's also how much story he can tell without saying any dialogue. You know, you look at his face, and there's a scene in the film where Michael and him go to visit the grave of Michael's old ex-wife, and he just looks at Michael at that point, and Michael's talking to his ex-wife at the grave and stuff, and it's really moving. And the boy is doing so much without saying anything.
We'll take some. Trouble. Would you like some tea, Stephen?
Yes, I noticed that's like a bit of a tea party.
Would you like
cake?
Okay, tea and cake. Nick, give us some trouble.
I'm sticking with coffee. I just want to be absolutely clear about this.
Stephen Fry and David Morrissey when they came and visited the programme back in May. Now, Ken Loach, when we get a visit from him, it's always something to look forward to. However, when he came around promoting his latest film, Looking for Eric, he was joined by the philosophising footballing genius that is Eric Cantona, although Mark was obviously only aware of him through his film work. We asked him about working with one of the co-stars in the film, Steve Evans.
I think it's worth mentioning that one of the reasons that Looking for Eric works as well as it does is you have this extraordinary performance by Steve Evans, who I think is just a wonderful actor. And I wonder whether, Eric, you can say something about working with Steve and what he was like.
It's been great time. The first time I met him, he didn't know that I would be in the film. I was a co-producer, so I read the script before. But in Ken's film, the actors don't know about the stories. They have the lines in the evening for the day after. They don't know about the story. So I've been hiding since I appeared for the first time. He was in front of the poster in the wall, and arrived discreetly behind him, and I said something, and he turned around, and Ken could have his real reaction. And yeah, it was the first time I met him. And after it was important that the connection was good between us. And it has been a great help for me.
Because we should say this is a key moment in the film. Up until now, little Eric, who we've been talking about, is addressing big Eric on a poster. And he talks to the poster. And then at this key moment, so he didn't know that you were going to be there. So when he turns around and looks stunned, he genuinely is stunned. Yes.
Yeah, it was. I tried to say in my previous sentence.
Where were you hiding?
Yeah, I've been hiding since I appeared for the first time. Yeah, maybe he can explain.
Well, we said to Steve, go and have a cigarette. We just got to rejig the lighting, so we put a black drape around, and Eric hid behind the black drape. But I'm glad you mentioned Steve, Mark, because. I thought he was very nice to work with, and he's very true. You know, his responses, like all good actors, his responses are very intuitive and very straight and very true.
He just seems like such a wonderful screen presence. I saw him before in Summer, and he's absolutely natural, and yet what he does has complete conviction. I think he's a really wonderful actor.
Yes, and he makes you. He's funny, but he makes you sad for him as well.
I would like to make one complaint about the film, and I speak as a long-suffering Spurs fan, that the film has got lots of wonderful Eric football moments, discussing some of your finest goals. But then, of all the things to pick, your favourite moment in your footballing career, for Leeds, Manchester United, playing for France, whatever, the finest moment turns out to be a pass which led to a goal against Tottenham. So thank you very much, Eric Cantona. What was the matter? Why did you put... I mean, is that suitable for the film, or is it genuinely true that that pass is your favourite moment of your career?
It's... Of course, I love to score goals, and I love to receive a gift. But I give me more pleasure to offer a gift to somebody. Yeah, to give a pass to somebody. Try to give the perfect pass, the pass we dream to receive from somebody. Yeah, it's kind of generosity, but that's give me more pleasure. So it is very selfish because I choose to do that because it gives me more pleasure. So, but when the selfish is come from the generosity, I think it's much better. Yeah,
it still hurt. And there weren't any goals against Arsenal, Ken. Is a conspiracy, isn't it?
Well, it was. It smacked of conspiracy. Yes. Because the editor Jonathan Morris is a gooner, and we did have lengthy discussions in the cutting room, but he's under pressure from him. I caved in, you know, which is not a thing I'm usually known to do. But
no, I was going to say, I did mention at the beginning that you are both famously uncompromising.
Yes, well, there you are. Found out.
Ken Loach and Eric Cantona, and it was one of those. Interviews where, because of the status of Eric Cantona, particularly at a station like Five Live, I mean, he is iconic. So many people wandering past the glass doors, although we're just looking in. But he was charming and delightful, and he signed photographs, and he signed articles, and he signed film scripts and everything.
And the other thing that you got out of him in that interview was the fact that it was very much his project, that it wasn't that Ken Loach had come to him, it was that he wanted to make a film about his relationship with the fans, and that's where it started from. And then, you know, and then Ken Loach got involved and turned it into Looking for Eric. But he's clearly somebody who exists on many different planes.
And also that Ken Loach is hugely famous and fabulous in France, and that they love his movies, because an awful lot of them feel so British. That you're there thinking, why would they be big in France?
Well, he is an auteur, and bear in mind, you know, the auteur theory is essentially, a continental idea. Of course, he won the Palme d'Or for The Wind That Shakes the Barley just a few years ago, so he's a big Cannes favourite as well. So,
Marxist history, as I recall.
That's right.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live, Mayo and Kermode's Films of the Year.
Now, let's talk about My Name is Bruce. This might not have made a lot of money at the box office, but to horror fans, the Bruce in question, of course, being Bruce Campbell, and that's a huge name for them, almost as big as Eric Cantona is to those at Old Trafford. And he came into the studio here at 5 Live. He explained the character he plays in the film.
Right, I'm busy living my life as a C-grade actor in the movie. When a group of teenagers unwittingly resurrect Guan Di, the Chinese god of war.
How would you describe him?
Guan Di is the savior of the dead. He protects the dead and bean curd, because in a former life before he was a bean curd seller, and this is true, I'm not making any of this up, he was a bean curd seller, so he has a soft spot for bean curd. So that sort of gave us the hero and the Achilles heel at the same time, because in any horror movie, you have to have a creature. And yes. I have to say, I'm going to go on record right here on the BBC, no one has ever used Guan Di as their monster before. They've had lots of Godzillas and giants and things like that.
And no one has ever used bean curd as the creature's Achilles heel either.
No. So this movie is shockingly inventive, I guess you would
say.
It
is, and a very scary creature. I mean, it's clearly a bloke in a mask.
Oh, you picked up on that, did you?
With sort of bulbs behind...
No, we spent actually quite a bit of money removing those bulbs. We did. We did. We rotoscoped. We rotoscoped the bulbs out. You can see, I'll put it this way. You used to be able to see them better, and now you don't see them as much. Right. So just sit further back in the theater, and it'll look fine.
So here's this real monster. Yeah. He's afraid of bean curd, and so he turns up. And how does that impact?
Well, what happens? He's not afraid of bean curd. He has respect for bean curd.
He's the only thing he won't kill.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He'll kill everything.
And in fact,
you're
safe if you possess bean curd in his presence. If you don't,
in general,
all bets are off. But anyway, this actor is mistaken as being, because he's Bruce Campbell and has been in these horror films, and he's fought monsters, that a deluded teenager who unleashed this creature figures that the best thing to do is to kidnap and have him fight the creature to save the town of Gold Lick, Oregon.
And there is a key moment in which our hero finds himself in the boot of a car stashed with Fangoria magazine, at which point I thought, there we go.
He's going to read one of my reviews.
Yeah, unlikely since it was a long time ago.
And of course, it turns out to be a very bad idea.
Tell us why, Bruce.
Well, since the actor doesn't know anything. Actors, as you know, don't really have any skills. We fake everything. If with a fight scene, half of it's our stuntman. We don't make up the lines of dialogue. Other people make us look pretty and sound good. And the writers make us sound intelligent or stupid.
No,
so we're really just little
that
puppets.
To upset me.
Oh?
I know it's really you. What? You know, I know you really did fight the Evil Dead and the Army of Darkness, and I don't care what you say.
I won't burst your little bubble.
I should tell you, Bruce, that you are talking to someone who thought that Elvis was still alive for many, many years.
And Bubba Hotep, I think, kind of proved that.
It did, didn't it?
It did, exactly.
But he's dead now. He died at the end of the
movie.
Yeah,
the end of Bubba Hotep, I know. That which
is
really,
that depressing?
It was a bittersweet thing for me, wasn't it? He's alive, no, he's dead.
I'm sorry about that.
How long did this movie take to film from start to finish?
Days. Many, many, many days.
How much did it cost?
Thousands of dollars. I'm not allowed to reveal that information.
Why not?
Because what happens is then you will judge it accordingly. I should just say millions of dollars.
Mm. And it took many months.
Hard work. It took days. You know, I'll tell you the truth. I have a reverse arrogance. In the B-movie world, we can slow down and spend more money. We can make Armageddon. If you let us make it, we'll make Armageddon. But can Michael Bay make a movie in 23 days with a single camera, with no special, with no stunt people? We're using this movie at all.
Can Michael Bay make a movie in 28 months with all the money in the world? To which the answer is Michael Bay couldn't direct Traffic.
Well, I didn't want to go there, but thank you for clarifying that.
We got a great response to Bruce Campbell. A lot of people, including me, weren't really aware of his back catalogue.
Well,
until he came in.
To anybody who sort of embraced The Evil Dead when it first came in, the thing that's important about The Evil Dead, of course, it was found guilty of infringing the Obscene Publications Act during the Video Nasty scare, which was just hilarious because it is clearly a comedy with blood and guts standing in for custard pies. But he's great. If only all actors were as much fun as that. If only all actors were as upfront about the camera. I love the fact when he says, you know, we don't do anything. We don't tell the lines. It's, you know, it's all stuntmen. He's got no ego on him at all. He's lovely.
Reverse arrogance. I don't think I'd heard that phrase before. That was Bruce Campbell. Now, of Time and the City.
Yeah.
What?
No, yes, of Time in the City, yeah.
I hadn't completed this out. All I said was of Time in the City, and you said yes.
It's impossible for me not to say something affirmative when you mention of Time in the City.
It was your favourite film of 2008.
Yeah, I loved it. Loved it. Have you seen it yet?
Can I just finish this? I just want to play a bit of Terence Davis, but you keep saying yes.
Okay.
Mark's favourite film of 2008. Done that. So when it came out on DVD, it seemed only fair. Here we go. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
To speak to its director, Terence Davis.
Watching Of Time in the City in Cannes was one of those moments when this is why I love cinema. And if I can have one of these every year, then I can sit through any number of terrible Vince Vaughn comedies and survive.
Okay. So would you agree with that, Terence Davis?
Well, when you make them yourself, you don't feel that they're part of you. Once it's finished, it's something different. And it has to go out into the world and be judged like that. But all you can do, and all I've ever tried to do, even when the films haven't worked, like Neon Bible, is to make it as passionately as I knew how. And we only had a tiny amount of money. We had 250,000, that's all. 35,000 went on music, 90 on archive material. I just looked back to the city that I knew and grew up in, and I had an intense relationship with that city and my family and my environment, because my environment was tiny. It was the family, the church, school, the movies, and God. That was it. And they were very, very intense years. After my father died, when I was seven, and we began to live as a family because he was psychotic. From 7 to 11, it was like being in heaven. It was like paradise. I mean, I was sick with happiness. We began to live, and that house became a magnet for all my sisters' and brothers' friends. It was a wonderful, wonderful atmosphere. And all I did was try to create that. But also, I'm fascinated by the nature of time and memory and how memories are triggered by tiny things. I think one of the great influences on me was the four quartets read by Alec Guinness over four nights in 1962 on primetime television. I didn't understand them because I was only 18, but the effect on me was revelatory. I think I read them every month now. I just tried to be true to that experience, and that's all any filmmaker can do. Once it's finished, it's for other people to decide whether it's any good or not.
Were you surprised at the reaction to the movie?
I was astonished. I was absolutely astonished.
Because?
I couldn't believe that, even if it had only been the Liverpool diaspora all over the world, but, I mean, one man took his grandmother to see it, and she recognised people on the screen. I found that quite extraordinary. And it seems to have pricked a lot of people's memories, because I suppose I tried to be true to my own. The most upsetting thing which happened, I think, was I showed it in Liverpool, and one of my sister's friends called Monica Kelly, we always called her Mickey, she loved my mother, and because her own mother was quite strict, and she came round to the house one day, this was when my father was alive, and my mother opened the door and she said in a quiet voice, Mickey, will you comb my hair? He won't let me comb my hair. And it just brought all those memories flooding back as to how awful he had been. And then when he died, she got her hair done for the first time. And I thought, oh, how beautiful she looked. And she was the great love of my life. I loved her enormously. So it brought back many, many memories for me. Also, unpleasant memories, like, you know, I was a terribly devout Catholic. I mean, I really was devout. I thought if I pray and I'm really good, then, you know, I will be made, everything will be made whole and I'll be like everybody else. And that was awful to realise at 22, that it was just a lie. That was hard. But memory has that bittersweet quality of bringing back intense emotions that you felt with such power that you thought you're going to die from happiness, like being taken to see, you know, All That Heaven Allows or Love Is a Many Splendid Thing by my sisters, or the intensity of, you know, being in a confessional in the dark at seven, thinking, you know, God knows every sin that I've ever committed. So it's a mixture of those extremes.
But I would like to say, and I think this is important, because after the film came out, I went with Terence to the church in which you lost your faith. And I do think that what happened to you was that all the faith and all the reverence and all the spirituality that you had from church went into the cinema. And I will hold to this day that when you go to the cinema, for you, it's like going to church. And I do think that's true.
I mean, you've said that to me before, and I think you're right. The trouble with it is, because I feel so intensely about it, and I'm not trying to make myself sound better than anybody else, I do feel it intensely. When I don't like something, I'm in such a fury for days. I think this is ridiculous.
But that's why that's why I like you, because you find it impossible to not react to
something. Listen, Terence, just one final question, if I may. With the success of Time in the City, which is out now on DVD, but with the success and the acclaim that has had, will you find it easier to finance future projects or not?
No. One comedy collapsed on the 1st of April because everybody pulled the money out. I'm trying to do an Ed McBain book and we come back to the same old thing. We need names. So, no, it's just as difficult as it always is.
And still one of your favourites.
Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely wonderful.
And David Morrissey likes it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really marvellous when other people share your sort of, you know, your film. But David Morrissey, who knows an awful lot about Liverpool, said he thought it was a pretty overwhelming experience too.
That was Terence Davis, of course. Now you're listening to BBC Radio 5 Live. Keep listening for John Ronson, Bill Forsyth. It's interesting that you say Bruce Forsyth.
But Bill Forsyth.
But it's Bill Forsyth.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why do you emphasise the Scythe and not the Four?
I don't know. I mean,
it is Bill Forsyth, isn't it?
Well, I've always said Bill
Forsyth. Forsyth. That doesn't sound right.
No, Bill Forsyth.
So it's John Ronson. That's fine.
John
Bill
Ronson.
Forsyth. I think we're heading towards Mark's favourite films of the year. So, The Men Who Stare at Goats. Great poster. Not a bad film either. Starred George Clooney and tells the story of a reporter meeting a special forces agent who reveals the existence of a secret psychic military unit whose goal is to end war as we know it. The film was based on the book of the same name by John Ronson, who came into the programme to fill us in on the background to the story.
I mean, the US military has always had this mandate, this kind of self-imposed mandate to journey to the furthest corners of their imaginations to try stuff out and do it in a kind of unashamed, unembarrassed way. So that's the rather good heart of this endeavour. And sometimes real-world things happen, like, for instance, the high-visibility jacket, they would argue, is a military invention that wouldn't have happened if the military weren't out-of-the-box thinkers. And then you've got kind of crazy real-life endeavours like the gay bomb,
What's the gay bomb?
Oh, the gay bomb was this pheromone that they spent ages trying to invent so that they would drop on the enemy and turn the enemy gay. And at the same time, they'd drop a halitosis bomb so the enemy would be both attracted and confused and also repelled. And the Americans would come in and in the confusion win. And so that was one. Then
now you could just say anything. You could make anything up now. They had a bomb, and when they dropped it, we all had to play musical chairs, you know, and it played music. And I don't know, it was just ridiculous stuff.
So isn't the crucial element to all this that as long as they think the other side might be doing it, they have to? Isn't that the kind of crucial funding thing?
Yeah, there was certainly a lot of that paranoia. And, of course, the other side weren't doing it. But then when they found out that the Americans were doing it,
then they had to do it.
Absolutely. And of course, for 20, 30 years, you know, none of it worked.
Well, for 40, 50, infinite years, none of it worked because it's all rubbish.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. They never became invisible. They never managed to walk through a wall. They never managed to drop a goat just by staring at it. They do claim that one goat fell over while being stared at.
Well, I was going to say, some of the, without talking too much about what happens in the film, people might come away from the film not thinking that it's all rubbish.
Mm. Well, the film, what I really like actually about the film is, you know, my book's very sceptical and you don't really think that these powers are possible. But in the film, they toy more with that possibility because I think you can do that in a film. And that was Peter, the screenwriter's invention, that you don't know whether George Clooney has these powers or not. And I rather like that sort of playfulness about the film.
See, I still, that's still my main quibble.
You're still bridling about that, aren't you?
Well, The whole thing is they don't have these powers.
Mm. I think the film is quite clear that they don't. I think there's a playful...
But that isn't the case. George Clooney parts the cloud.
No, he doesn't part the... No, he doesn't.
Well,
that's
a very literal
interpretation of what he does.
Well, given that he says, oh, I'm just going to part the cloud, he looks into the sky, does his eye wrinkly thing, and the clouds part.
Yeah, but that's...
What's that then?
The clouds are just parting. It's just that he happens coincidentally to be doing his eye-wrinkly thing at the time. No, it is. That's fine. The thing that really got your back up was at the very end, there's a suggestion that somebody actually does run through a wall.
Are you giving away the ending?
No, but it's not, because I think that's just a little flourish. I think that's a little quirk. It's not meant to be taken seriously. That bit is just a gag at the end of the film. But I think for most of the film, the suggestion is they have no powers at all.
Hmm.
But that's not made things better for you, has it?
No.
You're such a rationalist.
Anyway, John will probably be very glad. John Ronson, you've just been listening to, probably glad not to be talking about that for a long time because the book came out ages ago. He came in to talk about the book, and then he's talked about the movie, and then he moves on to other projects.
He went on tour with talking about the movie, but he did say on his Twitter feed that he particularly enjoyed speaking to you about it.
Excellent. John Ronson on The Men Who Stare at Goats. Now, a splendid chat with Bill Forsyth, who actually is a bit of a cheat because he didn't actually release a film in 2009. But of course, he was good enough to join us when Wittertainment travelled to Edinburgh to do the show there from the city's Cineworld Cinema. And he did make Local Hero. And when you think about it, he's one of the few people who can bring the good doctor to his knees.
Local Hero is one of the films that you and I agreed about very, very early on, as if you were picking, you know, top five movies ever made.
Yes,
Local
and we both had it as the second best film.
Both had
ever.
It as number two.
Yes.
With Simon, it was behind Amadeus. With me, it was behind The Exorcist. You and I have discussed this. It's okay.
I'm sure Bill is relieved to know that's okay then.
But he is essentially one of those filmmakers who made films that were really, really important in my sort of evolution of watching cinema, and whether it's Sinking Feeling or Gregory's Girl or Comfort and Joy, which of course I think is a wonderful piece of work, Local Hero, House Community. Every single Bill Forsyth movie has something in it of the magic of cinema, something that actually reminds you just what a magical, transcendent form cinema can be. And, I mean, it's terrible, because I start talking about it, even now I'm starting to well up. I'm so moved by your cinema, and I'm so thrilled that you're here, Bill, because you are a genuine, living legend and a genius.
Oh, shucks. I don't know what to say.
Thanks for having me in the mall.
Was that embarrassing, Bill?
Everything's embarrassing for me. Bill doesn't like watching his own films, and he doesn't like being praised, so that was excruciating for him. And the last time I was with him, we took him to Penland to go and we put on a screening of Local Hero in the place where it was filmed, and we showed it there in the newly built Village Hall with some people who'd been in the film, the original Cayley band. And we sat at the back of the hall watching this, and Bill and I talked, which, of course, we shouldn't have done during the course of the film.
Well, the one thing that you always lecture everybody about is people who make a noise in the cinema, people who talk in the cinema, people who eat noisily in the cinema.
Yeah.
And then just because you were on the Culture Show and on television, you sat at the back of the cinema with Bill, and you talked all the way through the film.
And I get into real trouble for it, because it turned out one of the comments I made was about the lighting in one of the scenes, one of the night scenes. And the next thing, an email from Chris Ming, as the guy who'd shot it, you know, 25 years ago, said, "You should have said you wanted it that way." You know?
Why do you have that responsibility to your films? I mean, and you've been quoted in the past saying that you don't own a copy of Local Hero.
I wouldn't have anywhere to keep it. I mean, I'd have to keep it under the bed or whatever. They're better off in fridges, these celluloid prints, anyway. Nowadays, with CDs, if somebody wants to send me a CD, I'll be quite happy with that. But,
Bill, it is possible to go and buy a DVD of your own work.
Yeah. I have been known to creep around Blockbuster and check out the cassettes and see if they're there. They used to have two, down in Partick in Glasgow, they used to have two of Comfort and Joy, you know, with Billy Paterson with his nose with an ice cream cone on it. So I used to walk past that most Friday nights and see if anyone was watching it.
But you were famous for not watching it, because one of the things that Bill said when we were watching Local Hero, and we'd gone through quite a lot of effort to get this screening on, to get Bill there to see it, because he's not a fan of seeing his own stuff, and we were watching the movie. And you leaned over to me and you suddenly said, "This is a television version of the film." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's scenes missing." And I said, "No, Bill, I've seen this film about 60 or 70 times. Uh-huh. There's nothing missing." Uh-huh. And what you were remembering was the script.
The first prints. And also the earlier prints before people...
Because you literally hadn't watched it since it had been made.
Yeah. No, usually when I cut a film, it's maybe 10, 20 minutes too long. So you always go through that kind of process of... Which is the worst process of all, when you're arguing with the producer and the exhibitors about the final. There was one film in which I think we took out one frame at the start and end of each shot, you know, and that through the course of the movie ended up bringing out the minute or two that they wanted out, so we didn't actually lose anything.
Bill Forsyth, you love him.
Bill Forsyth, I love him.
Did I say Forsyth?
Yeah, because you did the Forsyth saga thing. Yeah, Forsyth.
Okay, filmmaker and genius Bill Forsyth.
Yes, that's right.
Does that work?
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Mayo and Kermode's Films of the Year.
So we've witted on at great length, and we haven't actually got anywhere near the top 10 movies of 2009, which is the whole purpose of his being here.
It is.
Really.
We usually start with top 10, but we're now going to end with top 10.
So here it comes then. We'll do the top 10 movies of 2009, according to Mark Kay. At number 10, White Lightning.
Which literally came and went in cinemas very, very quickly. And I want to recommend this because it was very little seen. It's directed by Dominic Murphy. Years and years ago, I made a documentary with Dominic Murphy. He directed this documentary, Fear in the Dark, about horror movies for Channel 4. And the only way of describing this, it is the best Appalachian mountain dancing...
Appalachian.
Is that the word?
Appalachian. If you come from Appalachia, you say Appalachian. Everyone else is Appalachian. I just thought I'd tell you...
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, fine. Psychotic, surreal, it's true, but it isn't fantasy. And it's a very, very strange movie, and it has, you know, psychosis and weirdness and death and tap dancing. Mountain dancing, I believe, is the actual term for it. And very fine performance by Carrie Fisher. And it's out on DVD. It was only in the cinema for a couple of days, but I think it's really grown on me. It is very odd.
I was hoping that we might be able to take the programme to the Appalachian Mountains.
Oh, really?
But I couldn't actually think of a really, really good reason. I just wanted to go.
Yeah, it'd be lovely to go.
It's fantastic. So White Lightning's at number 10. A Serious Man is at number 9.
Yeah, and you were slightly surprised by this. Here's why I put Serious Man in. When I first saw it, you and I discussed this on the London Film Festival programme that we did for the Culture Show, and I said it's a strange, widgety little movie. It was like the Coen brothers. They'd had, you know...
I still don't know what that means, but say that.
They'd had, you know, they'd won the Best Picture Oscar with No Country for Old Men, then they'd done that kind of guest list movie in the shape of Burn After Reading. Then they'd made this thing. When I saw it, I thought, I really like this, but it's, you know, it's got very limited appeal. Then, of course, course, it turned out that people really liked it. And the reason I put it in my top 10 list here is because I was really impressed by the fact that a movie that was so obviously not made for general, you know, it wasn't made worrying about the audience at all, had did such great reviews and also such good audiences. In the year, I think the Coens could make a very singular film and it would find an audience in the way it did.
Yeah, I just want. It was just so. Because it was the greatest.
Say, Abelman. Surely you're jesting. It's a great film. And the thing I'm saying about this was it was one of those films that would have got more awards if it had looked like he was trying hard. What he did for the Dirty Harry, what he did for, you know, The Man Without a Name, and The Man With No Name. And I just thought it was a lovely piece. And it's like he's just not trying. He's got such a fine understanding of cinema. He's so lean. He's so unfussed. It's really fine.
What about the Oscars, though, Nick? American comedian, who part of the routine was used to say as part of the song, which is a hit for America, of course. If you've been in the dead, I've cleaned that up just a little, and got it as well. Anyway. So Gran Torino is at number 8, and has a sort of it's sort of like an American version of the Michael Caine film, which came at the end of the year.
Except it isn't. You see, the Michael Caine film,
same kind of thing, though.
No,
old guy. With a gun.
Yeah, no, but the Michael Caine film, old guy run, good idea. Let's go shoot the hoodies, that'll make sense. The whole point of Gran Torino was, no, violence won't solve anything at all. And of course, without wanting to give away the end does not turn into the him going out and sorting everything out with a gun. In fact, it's a religious allegory.
Seven, this year's number seven is Helen.
This week's number seven.
Yeah, this week's number seven.
Again, very little seen movie, which I really, really liked, and I sort of attempted to sort of flag up on the programme, so anybody got a chance to go and see it, go and see it. It's a very low-budget British movie about a young woman.
Called Helen,
who is it's about a girl disappears, somebody else is cast to play her in the police reconstruction. It kind of owes a lot to Antonioni and, you know, blah, blah, things like that. And I've now seen it four or five times, and it's a beautifully mysterious British movie that costs no money to make whatsoever and has a very strange, creepy feel about it. And again, I would have loved it to have had a wider release, more, you know, to be seen by more people, but I was very encouraged to see that Philip French mentioned it in his roundup of the year as well. He liked it very much. It's a very, very fine piece of work.
Your extensive wide reading, that'll be The Observer.
The Observer, then, yes.
It must be great fun in your house reading the papers. Antichrist at number 5. Well, that's preposterous.
Yeah, let's go back to number 6, which you've skipped over.
Oh, yeah. We've got Moon at number 6.
Yes. Now, you've seen Moon, right?
No.
Oh, but we had him on the programme.
We had Mr. Moon. We had Mr. Moon on the programme. It hadn't come out at that time, and only you exclusive reviewers had seen it.
That's right. This was the Edinburgh Film Festival. Yep. It was Duncan Jones, his debut feature. Of course, it's done very well since then. Duncan Jones, as you pointed out, when we did the interview with him, you said, how long can it be in an interview before somebody says, formerly Zowie Bowie?
Yeah, because he's David Bowie's son. But of course, you can't start with that. You can't introduce him as that. But no, it kind of came up in the conversation.
But what happened, what was in the case of your interview with him, was that he brought it up, yes, not you, because he
always
said,
the best way.
I used to knock around making Super 8 cine films with my dad. And then you went, who was? You see, you're
gotcha.
An opening there. You're going to... It's a really fine piece of work. I mean, it's. I have to say, when I saw it, I didn't. It didn't clock. I just saw the name Duncan Jones. I didn't clock, oh yes, Duncan Jones, formerly the artist known as Zowie Bowie. What I really loved about it was a throwback to those 60s and 70s science fiction movies in which it was all to do with inner space rather than outer space. Sam Rockwell on the moon on his own with only a computer, voiced by Kevin Spacey. The computer obviously owes a lot to HAL from 2001. But it was a film about ideas. It was a film which was very stylishly done, but it was a film about ideas. It was a film about performances. It was about isolation and humanity as opposed to being about robots hitting each other or wars in outer space. I thought it was a really good piece of work, and on the basis of this, he is a talent to watch out for.
Match number 6, Antichrist at 5. That's a stupid place to put it.
Did you see it?
Well, I saw it, and apart from the bits where you rang me and said, I wouldn't watch this if I were you, but...
Did you fast forward through those bits?
Yeah, well, only because you told me to. You said there's no point in you watching this.
No, what I said was that there were bits in it that you would just go, oh, for heaven's sake. I mean, there are bits in it that made me go, oh, for heaven's sake. In fact, people actually wrote in and say, what were the bits? And it was the bits with the scissors... and we don't need to fill in any more detail on that.
No.
But what I really liked about it was this. I thought it was an exciting movie that was but equal parts exciting and exasperating. And there were things in it that you go, wow, that's, you know, that's real, because it's a horror movie. You know, two guys go to, a man and a woman go out to a cabin in the woods, and you know, with scissors, and really bad stuff happens. And there's a key moment in it in which they come across the talking fox, and the fox turns towards the camera and says, "Chaos reigns." And one of two things happens. You either burst out laughing and go, "That's fantastic, Mr. Fox," or you go, "Oh, that's creepy." And that's it. That's the point at which the audience is completely divided.
Is it Christian Bale voicing the fox? Because that's what it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they all sound exactly the same. But you should give Antichrist a go now. I think it's a really fun. You know, okay.
The White Ribbon is at number four.
Michael Haneke's best work, and a very fine piece of cinema. I mean, I'm not alone in putting this in my top 10 of the year. And many critics have put it up there. The thing about it is, it's a film in which some of Michael Haneke's movies in the past have been like being lectured and being told off. Some of them have been incredibly sadistic and cruel. I mean, Funny Games is a really, really unpleasant viewing experience, which is what it's meant to be. The thing with White Ribbon, which is essentially pre-war Village of the Damned, is it's a film which exists entirely on the level of ominous dread. Bad stuff is going to happen, but you're not quite sure what it is. And in the end, it turns out that the bad stuff that's going to happen is two world wars. And in fact, it's the Second World War that is the really bad stuff. We never get there at all. But I sat in the cinema feeling really uncomfortable. So it's in at number four for the most uncomfortable experience of the year in the cinema.
Anvil, the story of Anvil, is a splendid positioning there at number three.
You loved it, right?
Oh, it was great.
And what? Okay, so you tell me.
David Morrissey, the omnipresent David Morrissey, sent me an email in which he said, "Mark and you, or you and Mark, need to get yourself down to see this film."
Because, this was last year, of course.
Because I've just seen it in America, and it's going to be huge. And so it turned out.
And he saw it in 2008. So when I say last year, I mean the year, because we're now in 2010. But he saw it and he flagged it up then. He
flagged it up. And as soon as we got a chance to have Mr. Lips on the programme to talk about it, we had him on. And it's a great film.
And it's the love story of the year, because it's, you know, it is a genuine love story between those two central guys. The fact that one of the guys, the man is called Rob Reiner, always seemed to me to be an indication that actually they're making this up, that they were a Spinal Tap invention, that they didn't really exist. Because at the beginning, when you watch it, you think, this can't be real. This band can't. How come I've never heard of them? Because you were...
Including the camera. One of the cameramen actually thought exactly that. Got halfway through the film and just thought, no, excuse me, I think we're watching something which is being acted, but it's not.
But as you know, a key Radio 1 DJ of some standing and some years, had you ever heard of Anvil?
Never, 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 never heard of Anvil at all. So I did check them. In fact, while I was watching the DVD, you know, you can check them up and look them up, and you can see the records that have been released. You know, it is possible to buy them. Never played Anvil. We didn't mess around in that kind of world. That was Tommy Vance.
But no,
Tommy Vance, bless him, if he was still with us, he would have known about
Anvil. But it is extraordinary that it starts off with this footage of them playing some Monsters of Rock festival with huge bands. You think, how did I not know about them? But it's wonderful. It's really heartbreaking, and it's a real love story, and I wish them all the best. I wouldn't want to listen to their music because it sounds ghastly to me, but they are just wonderful.
Number two, Slumdog Millionaire.
Or, as you liked to say...
Slumdog Milliner?
Milliner. Slumdog Milliner.
Well, that's the way he says it.
It's funny. This is obviously, this list is based on films that were released this year. So I know, obviously, there's stuff that's coming up in here that, you know, that was around the year before. But this was UK release was this year. It kind of really bothers me when critics say, oh, yes, my favourite films of the year. And it's all stuff which is coming out next year. So this is stuff. Slumdog Millionaire obviously won the Oscar for Best Picture. And we really need to remember that it was never made as a mainstream film. It was a little, you know, quirky, offbeat thing that almost ended up going straight to video. I mean, Danny Boyle talked about this quite a lot, that it almost didn't see theatrical release. And then it turned into this enormous sensation. I'm still slightly bothered by that poster, which said the feel-good film of the year, or the feel-good film of the decade, I think they referred to it. When you're watching the opening scenes of the Mumbai street kids being hideously mistreated, you think, when am I going to start feeling good? But it was such a great piece of work. Dev Patel, you know.
Star of The Last Airbender.
Star of The Last Airbender, yes.
Something to look forward to next year.
But Slumber, it really was something, wasn't it? It was an extraordinary thing. And I know we've all kind of assimilated it now, but it really, for that to have won Best Picture, that's a mark. That's the best picture win in years.
And when Danny Boyle sort of tells the story, which he's done many times, about how it almost just didn't happen.
No, it's wonderful.
So Slumdog Millionaire is there at number two, and according to Mark Kermode, the number one movie of 2009, as we are now here in 2010, but something to enjoy and cherish, and you could probably pick up for $3.99 if you're looking in the right kind of DVD store, You announce it. Take it away.
Well, again, on the basis of UK release, although it was made in, you know, before that, because I think a lot of people saw it in 2008 at festivals, Let the Right One In. Again, this was a David Morrissey tip. There's two movies in the top ten that David Morrissey got the, you know, got wind of first and said...
He might as well just take over the show.
He might as well, yeah, because he's, you know, he's better looking and he sounds nicer on the radio.
He's got nicer glasses.
He has got nicer glasses, but not for very long. And but it's just a wonderful reinvention of vampire mythology, because there really hadn't been much Swedish vampire mythology up until that point. It's directed by Thomas Alfredson. It's based on a novel which takes its title from a Smith song. And it is... It's a vampire movie that isn't about sex. It's a vampire movie that is about childhood anger and frustration and bullying on one level. And it is interesting that since I saw the film, I have gone back and read the book, and there are things in the book that are specifically taken out of the film to give the film a kind of purity of intention. I think Thomas Alfredson has done a wonderful job of bringing it to the screen. It is, for me, this year's Pan's Labyrinth. And an example, once again, of what you can do with fantasy cinema if you understand that essentially fantasy and reality occupy the same territory. It's not that one of them is to do with, you know, Ooga Booga and Hobbits and all that sort of stuff. It is that there is a very thin line between fantasy and reality. And it's a wonderful story about the traumas of childhood. You know, it was interesting that we were talking a few weeks ago about Spike Jonze saying that Where the Wild Things Are, it's not a children's movie, but it's a movie about childhood. Well, that's absolutely true of Let the Right One In. It's clearly not a children's movie, but it is a movie about childhood, which also happens to be a vampire movie. And I just think it's a sparkling, glittering gem of a movie. And if I can have one of those every year, I could keep on doing this forever.
Is that a threat or a promise?
I think it's both.
So stuff to look forward to in this new year of 2010, apart obviously from our brand new exciting show.
Yes.
Now from 2 till 4.
From 2 till 4.
It'll be very, very similar to what we've been doing, but just a little bit longer.
Well, hopefully on the very first show, we're going to have the star of Something to Look Forward To, which is Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, which is the biopic of Ian Dury starring Andy Serkis. And we'll review the film, you know, in a week's time. But let me say now, Andy Serkis' performance in that film is really something. In the same way as, you know, Joaquin Phoenix becoming Johnny Cash, but doing something else with that role in Walk the Line. What Andy Serkis manages to do with the characterization of Ian Dury is to take a character that we all knew very well, at least we thought we knew, you know, from live performances. And for some reason, I remember seeing Ian Dury play drums for Reckless Eric, and take it somewhere else and do something with him. And Andy Serkis is such a great actor, and his performance in that film is, you know, that's a real great way to start off the year. It's really something that's worth looking forward to. There are apparently new movies in the pipeline. Terrence Davis hopefully has started working on his new movie. I think,
is it in colour?
Shall I have a word with him?
And 3D, that would be fantastic.
Terrence Davis in 3D. Yes, the thing that I'm looking forward to most in the coming year is the death of 3D. That's actually, you've cut to the chase there. That's what I'm looking forward to most, is the taking off of the silly glasses.
Well, it ain't going to happen.
Do you want to, actually, I'll tell you what, seriously, would you like to make me a bet that 3D declines with it? I would bet you that over the next 3 years, 3D does not expand exponentially but declines.
No.
Okay.
But it's not going to die, because that's just ridiculous.
Well, it can't die because they've spent so much money putting the screens up. No, but declining would be that I was right.
There will be more 3D. You won't like it, even if it's fantastic. That's just the way that it is.
You thought Avatar would have been fine in 2D.
No, you thought it would have been fine in 2D. I enjoyed the 3D immersion.
But you thought it
enough
would be
of that,
fine
because
in 2D.
If you want more, you'll have to wait a whole week for 2 hours of Wittertainment starting a week today. Oh, and Mark.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Simon.
On DAB digital radio, digital TV, downloads, and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.